So we're coming to the end of the retreat. And before I talk about how to make your whole life practice, somebody asked to share the monkey on the golf course story. So I'll start with that. And I think it also speaks to something that was in all the questions, and that's the attachment, and how we either attachment or rejecting the way things are, and how that causes suffering. And this story speaks to that. Okay. A number of decades ago, when the English had colonized India, they wanted to set up a golf course in Calcutta. Besides the fact that the English shouldn't have been there in the first place, the golf course was not particularly a good idea. The biggest challenge was that the area was populated with monkeys. The monkeys were apparently interested in golf too, and their way of joining the game was to go onto the course and take the balls that the golfers were hitting and toss them around in all directions. Of course, the golfers didn't like this at all, so they tried to control the monkeys. First, they built high fences around the fairway, and they went to a lot of trouble to do this. Now, monkeys climb, so they would climb over the fences and onto the course. That solution didn't work at all. The next thing they tried was to lure them away from the course. I don't know how they tried to lure them, maybe waving bananas or something, but for every monkey that would go for the bananas, all their relatives would come into the golf course and join in the fun. In desperation, they started trapping them and relocating them, but that didn't work either. The monkeys just had too many relatives who liked to play with golf balls. Finally, they established a novel rule for this particular golf course. The golfers in Calcutta had to play the ball wherever the monkey dropped it. It'd be quite a game of golf. So this is pointing to the, you know, how we want things to be a particular way. We want the conditions to be just so, and life doesn't always cooperate. Maybe it does for a while, and that even makes us want to hang on tighter, and then things change. So it's like the monkeys are dropping golf balls where you don't want them. So what can we do? So we tend to either blame. Reactive ways, blame ourselves, blame others, might become aggressive, we might feel victimized and resigned to the fact, we might soothe ourselves with food or drink, and we learn over time that none of these reactions work. They're not solving the problem at hand. So how do we find peace? We need to pause and say, okay, this is where the monkey dropped the ball. I'll play it from here as best as I can. So just kind of pausing and think of how can I play this, relate to this, respond to this situation as best as I can. So can you think of a place in your life where things are not cooperating with how you'd like them to be? So you can focus on that. Could be something in a relationship, something that's happened in family or at work. Perhaps we were reactive in that situation. What would it be like to just play the ball from there? Tap into your deepest wisdom and relate to it with compassion. So that's the monkey on the golf course story. It's the that Sayadaw Tenjini is kind of formula for suffering. The more we're attached, and the more we want things to be a particular way, the more we suffer. This came powerfully home for me was at a retreat with my last teacher, Matthew Flickstein. And we'd go to retreats in, I think I mentioned in, or maybe it was in the small groups, I mentioned it, in West Virginia. And the retreat center was shaped like an H, so it had four wings, and then the sitting area was in the middle. And we were in there, and Matthew was giving a talk, and I was very interested. I love him, and I love listening to him speak about the Dharma. And then there's something else about this place is the toilets. If you don't push the handle back up and you after you flush the toilet, they continue to flush. And of course, at the beginning of the retreat, everybody's told this, and for the most part, we remember. This particular time, the room was right beside the Dharma room, the person had left the handle down on the toilet. And was making that, you know, that sound where it fills the tank endlessly. You think it's going to end, but it never does. So I'm really listening to Matthew's talk and this in the background, and I was suffering. I was attached to the talk. I was attached to that, to wanting to hear that and be with that talk. And the toilet flushing was disturbing that. It's not what I wanted, right? And the degree of attachment really came home to me, the degree of which I was attached. Something as simple as a toilet flushing was disturbing. Thoughts were coming up about whose room is that? And why doesn't the person, they must know it's their toilet. It's not my toilet, because my toilet's weak. And I'm right, and I'm just suffering and feeling. And then I thought, wow, this is what Matthew's actually talking about. Is how we create suffering by not being okay with the way things are. And then it occurred to me, I can just get up and go unflush the toilet. Of course, by that time, the suffering, and then the being with the suffering, and learn, and, you know, holding that moment so I could learn from it, had all transpired in the person, somebody else. I, you know, went up and unflushed the toilet. We were back to the talk. So just being okay with. I mean, this is, if you want to think about how to bring this this practice into your life, that's it right there. Noticing where you're stuck, where you're attached, where you're rejecting something in the present moment, or something in your past, or clinging to something in the future, and noticing how you suffer. To not judging, just noticing, oh, this is what it feels like when I react in this way. And this is what it feels like when I'm okay with the way things are. And it's that contrast where you start to reorient your way of being towards the responding mindfully and with awareness as you look at the contrast. Because spaciousness, openness, just feels bodily. The path. So I'm going to so meditation. So we've just done a retreat here, and we've been fairly intensely practicing. I don't know if you guys, folks, practice sitting meditation that much when you're at home on your own, but probably not. So it's a retreat, it's a way we're deepening our practice. Perhaps the mind settles a little bit, perhaps not. Allows you to be present with your experience. really get to know yourself, as I said at the beginning, getting to know, discover some things about what it's like to be human. It's basically what we're doing. And then how that, what we're doing in life is being human. So the meditation just is what we do through our lives. So we don't meditate for, you know, an hour in the morning to become a good meditator. We're just meditating. It's kind of to get to know this being human, so that it can be part of our life. Some people say so it can spill over into our life and we can integrate it into our life. But it is our life. It's just our life sitting with our eyes closed, as opposed to our life, you know, talking with a colleague at work, or our life interacting with our children, or whatever it might be. So it's not something we do in the morning and then just kind of forget about it. So it's awareness can be practiced in every moment of our lives. And it's that continuous awareness that is what is the practice. So there's this intent in the back of the mind to be aware in all our moments. Of course, we forget, then we're aware that we've forgotten. And we, the moment we're aware that we're not aware, we're aware. Right? So as soon as you, just like as soon as you recognize that your mind has wandered from the breath, it's, you're aware. You're back in awareness at that very, very moment. Like I say, you know, gently guide you, but you're already back. By the time you've noticed it, you're right back to awareness. So it's every time you just know, oh, I'm lost in mind chatter. That moment you're aware. So it's just that continuous awareness, and with a gentleness and a lightness. Sayadaw Tanjaniya talks about how if we're tight and focused, and you know, it just becomes too exhausting. I've heard people say, oh yeah, being mindful, I can do it for an hour, then I need a break. It's too exhausting. Perhaps the reason is it's too much efforting around it. Like holding objects can be very tiring. We don't meditate so that we learn about objects, right? Even though the breath is an object, we're using the breath as a reference point, but we're not doing this to get to know the breath or the sounds, or we're getting to know the mind. And how we suffer. We don't meditate. Did I say this? We don't meditate to become good meditators. Yeah. It's just John Kabat-Zinn talks about it as sewing your parachute for life. So when you need it, it's there. So there's another way to put it: tuning your instrument before an orchestra goes out for the performance, which is life. There, you can see them all tuning their instruments. You could look at it. If metaphors like that work for you. I don't know who said this. I have here it's a Zen saying, but I think Ajahn Chah said it, but I'm not sure. Maybe they've all said it. You should sit in meditation for at least 30 minutes a day, unless you're too busy. You know what's coming next, don't you? Unless you're too busy, then you should sit for an hour. It's funny, but it's true, right? Like, I've actually said that to people. Because people will say that in Sangha or in such. I'm just too busy. I said, oh, I've got the solution. Sit for an hour instead of 30 minutes. Not what they want to hear. So some So we've been practicing formal meditation here. Formal meditation, sitting. Formal sitting meditation or standing meditation. We've been practicing the yoga, so meditation while moving. We've been practicing the walking meditation. Another meditation that we didn't practice here is body scan meditation, lying down and just sensing into what's arising in different parts of the body. Well, those are formal meditation practices. So when I say you're meditating for a certain amount of time in the morning or the evening, that's I'm talking about the formal meditation where it's carving out a time to just be with yourself in a meditation. But as I said, meditation, the rest of your life, we call informal meditation. It's kind of interesting. It's all because it should be all meditation. So just some things that you can consider in how to practice the rest of your life. Just ways to remember and ways to, invite mindfulness, awareness into other aspects of your day. So, 1 minute of mindfulness, just taking a minute, interspersed during the day, just to pause, to connect with breath and body, be present, and then move on. You can set something up on your smartphone, on your computer. There's a mindfulness bell you can download that just goes ding every once in a while. You can have it randomly go off if that's something that can happen. Used to have it in my office at Carleton. A student might be sitting there in the office, and all of a sudden my computer would go, boom. And look at me. I'd explain what it is, and no. And you know what? Nobody went, wow, you're weird. They might have thought it, but they never said it. But they would actually pause. They'd explain what it was. Oh, okay. And it'd be like this pause. Well, that's... It seemed kind of like a natural thing to do, is just pause and connect with the moment. And I think it helps them sort of center, because there's a certain nervousness in the professor's office and so on. So just this 1 minute of mindfulness. If there's a mindfulness bell, as I said, you can use for that. Or just pausing. This was a practice I lived with the monk, the Thich Nhat Hanh monks, and they used to have a monastery in Barrie, Vermont, not Barrie, Massachusetts, but the other Barrie, and before they moved to Blue Cliff, and they did that. I mean, we were up at 4:10 meditating, and then meditating would stop at like 8 o'clock or something. We'd have like 4 hours of practice. And they'd still not, that's not enough. It's like still during the day. Somebody would just kind of randomly, they had this big bell. If you were near the bell, you'd just walk up and offer it, and everybody would stop what they were doing. Just pausing and reconnecting with the present moment. It's a beautiful practice, this stopping. Some organizations that have asked me, how do we become a mindful organization? That's among many other things, that's one thing I've suggested is offer a bell through the loudspeaker system to the whole office, and offer it as a mindful moment. See some people kind of smirking. Yeah, my place is really cool for that. These are like community health centers, places that have done it so far have been places that are connected with healing itself. STOP, it's an acronym you can practice to engage in kind of a minute of mindfulness. And it's particularly useful if you're noticing reactivity arising or stress arising. And the STOP acronym. So the S stands for stop. just pausing. you remember, I talked about that pause, that space between stimulus and response is your power to choose. And so it allows other options to emerge. Change is what happens next, and that's your power and freedom. So stop is a way to actually engage with that pause just by stopping. If you notice it, you just stop. The T is for take a breath. So really it's connecting. It's going to be more than one breath. It's just denoting connecting with the breath. The O is observe. So just noticing what's present bodily, mind, emotionally, in the heart, and then proceeding. It's a wonderful practice to again, planting that intention. Oh, I can practice stop when I'm feeling stress, or I feel like I'm reactive. Just so you plant that little intention in the back of your mind, and sometimes it might, you know, you might remember to do it. Other times you won't. And when you don't remember, you just kind of go, "Oh, I didn't stop. I didn't pause. I didn't allow that space." And just, this is how this feels. And then another time you might remember to stop and pause and go, "Ah, this is how this feels." Then be surprised. Like, notice what arises in that space when you talk when. Viktor Frankl talks about your power and your freedom. Is in that. Notice what can arise in that space other than throwing your stapler at your workmate. Something else might arise that's more helpful. pick a prompt to remind you to be mindful. You can put the word mindful around your house, your car, workplace. I used to have meditate on my remote, on the TV, in the fridge, on the beer fridge, the cottage, meditate. So just ways to remind you to be mindful. Anything you can do to prompt that, coming back to awareness. Being in nature. You know, if you notice how you, when you're in nature, you somehow feel connected. It's quiet, it's you're in a natural environment. Although there's lots happening in nature, it doesn't seem busy. Spending, you know, this beautiful forest we have here. It was raining most of the time, so maybe everybody didn't get to experience it. But just going for a walk in the woods, sitting in nature. Mindful listening. This is something I like to teach and encourage in people's practice for several reasons. One reason is many of our stressors, if not most of our stressors, come from social interactions, social situations. So although we're wired for fight, flight, freeze, to survive from predators eating us and things like that, we don't really have, you know, tigers, polar bears chasing us down the street. Our threats tend to be social, but we still fire that whole stress reaction system. And you'll notice, if you notice butterflies in your stomach, that's a signal that there's a stress reaction. You know, your stress reactive, your system is activated. Your HPA, sympathetic nervous system is activated because your body is pulling blood away from the digestion of your food because it needs the blood for either the fight or the flight. So to the limbs to run and so forth. And digesting food isn't a priority right now. There's a threat. we'll digest this later. We'll put our energies, put your system's putting energy elsewhere. So that's an interesting telltale. A lot of public speakers talk about, you know, butterflies in their stomach before they go and speak. So that's one reason why I think mindful listening is so critical, because we're bringing mindfulness into a place where we experience stress. The other is it's a beautiful gift to offer the world and the people that are around you, is to actually listen to what they're saying. I think if you engage in the practice, you'll notice how it is felt as a tremendous gift by those around you. Excuse me. I forget who said this. The greatest gift anyone's ever given me is when I spoke, they actually listened. Who said that? I have these quotes swirling around in my head. I need to actually remember the names of the people as well. but it's so true. And listening to more than just the words that they're saying, but really tuning into the entire message that they're communicating. I mean, those studies that people were done decades ago about where the message is contained. I forget the percentage, but it's a small percentage of the message is actually in the words. The rest of it's in facial expressions and body language. So really tuning into that, the whole person that's communicating. And also noticing what mental tendencies arise while you're listening. Is it the tendency to think about what you're going to say next? Is there a tendency to want to control what the person is going to do or say? Is there a tendency to want to jump in and interrupt? Just noticing those tendencies, these are patterns that arise when you're listening. Just notice them. Without necessarily acting on them. Just thoughts arise. Their thoughts arising. Back to listening. So you're in a way. The folks at Google who developed that mindfulness for the Google employees called it looping, and I don't know where they got that from. But the notion of when you're listening, your focus, your primary focus is on the person and what they're saying, but you're also now you're looping and you're looking at what's arising for you as you're receiving that message bodily, what's arising. So you might get some emotional content by being in tune with the body and what thought patterns are arising. And so it's kind of like peripheral vision, your experience of their message and the focus of is on what they're saying. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
As a way of listening. And that tendency to want to think about what you're going to say can be quite strong for many of us, rather than continuing to listen. By listening, you trust that when the person is finished, what needs to be said will emerge. Because you've really received what they said. So it's trusting emergence, trusting that it'll be there, because there's this word, they're going to finish talking and I'm not going to know what to say if I don't think about what I'm going to say while they're talking. I could say something really stupid. So it's trusting. And one thing I've noticed too is when the person finishes speaking, and I'm mindful and there's awareness present, And nothing arises for me to say. Silence is what arises. So I offer silence. It's amazing. What tends to happen is the person goes on and actually speaks a deeper truth. So silence was actually I didn't need to rehearse what I was going. What emerged was exactly what was needed in that moment. That kind of deeper wisdom that you have is present. Yeah. So let go of that. You know, thinking about what we're going to say. But notice it. That's a mental tendency. It's going to keep arising until the pattern is noticed and released. Right. Just allowing that pattern will eventually. It kind of loses its juice because it's not being acted on. It's a process of noticing that that's what's happening, that's arising. Building mindfulness into routine activities, like routine, so transforming your chores into mindfulness practices. Wonderful. I mean, a lot of what we do is fairly mundane stuff, right? When you break down your day, a lot of fairly mundane things. So can you bring mindfulness to those? The washing the dishes, brushing the teeth, whatever it might be, folding laundry, ironing, if anybody irons anymore, whatever, gardening. There's so many of these regular tasks. So bringing mindfulness into those, eating with awareness. Perhaps you had a chance to practice with that here on the retreat. Really enjoying the entire experience, the perhaps beginning with the scent of the food, and then reclaiming our pleasure with food. It not being filling the tank. I mean, as a young person, that's how I looked at eating, right? My mother even said it. I never stopped running around. I'd run by and she would just shove food in my mouth. I'd run by again, she'd shove some more food into my teens, and it didn't change much. It was just like, oh, fuel stop. off again. So reclaiming the pleasure of food. And there's enough research out there that shows that eating slowly and chewing our food properly is healthier, better for our health, better for our digestive system as well. So it's how we're supposed to eat our food, how we're meant to, how we're built to engage with food. Doing one thing at a time. This is an interesting one. Unitasking. Those who pride themselves in their ability to multitask might not like this one, but yeah, they try it out if it's not something you do. There's a cartoon that was floating around the internet that there's a woman, executive behind the desk, and calls in one of her employees and says, "I'm having a real problem here. I was wondering if you could help me. I'm looking for somebody in this corporation that knows how to unitask." So it's doing one thing at a time. And there's enough recent studies showing that when we do one thing at a time, we can be more productive. We make fewer mistakes. Or more thorough in completing the task, and it can actually be done more efficiently. And then moving on to the next task. I mean, it's not always possible, but it can be seen as something we can set our intent to. And we're also slowing down a little bit when we unitask, which allows us to be present with the moments of our life. Because we will miss our lives if we're not, the present moment is your life, and if you're not present with that, you're not present with your life. You're in an imaginary parts of your life. If in mind chatter, it's either the past, which is you're just your kind of recollection, usually inaccurate, because, and then the future, which is just an imagination of what might happen. So really, all you, what's your life is what's present, like right now. At the end of a retreat, we can the last couple sittings, you can actually not be present with the sitting. We can already be in our car going home, or we can already be home and thinking about what we're doing when we get home. Mindful walking. As Thich Nhat Hanh calls it, walk as if you are kissing the earth with your feet. A beautiful practice. And in the Thai and the Thich Nhat Hanh folks make it an integral part of their practice. Lots of mindful walking within their practice. His book, Peace in Every Step, you can see the reference to mindful walking in his teachings. I went to one of his retreats many years ago in the U.S. and there were 1,500 or so people at this retreat. So it was in a football stadium at a university, and all the residences were filled with people on this retreat. And they asked you on your form, you know, which residence would you prefer, what's your first, second, third choice for the residences? And I guess people put, so I just said it doesn't matter. People put the ones closer to the football stadium or the food. And since I said it didn't matter, I was put the furthest away from both. But it turns out that's where Thich Nhat Hanh was my neighbor. Mm-hmm. And all the monks were in this building that nobody else wanted to be in. And but we would get up in the morning, very early, they'd get up early and do their practice. So I joined them in their practice. And then we would walk to the stadium. And as we walked by each residence, mindful walking in silence, people were timed so that they would come out and join us. So we'd start with 25 people or so, add 50, add 200, add 300. By the end, it was 1,500 people in silence walking into this football stadium. And that really struck me, the kind of the joy and the of that walking practice. And you can do it, how much do you walk? You know, do people have Fitbits and all those little things? They tell you how many steps you take in a day. We got to get one that tells you how many of those are mindful. Yeah, so you do 10,000 steps. Only 1,000 of them were mindful today, so I'm going to try and get that up to 2,000. But that's, somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 steps if you can do all of those mindful. That's a lot of mindfulness practice. Just being aware of your steps, bringing awareness to your steps. So again, planting that intention in the back of your mind, when I step, when I kiss the earth with my feet, I'm going to do so with mindfulness. And so that's one way. Another way is to just pick, when I go from my car or the bus to my office, I'll do so mindfully. When I go to get a coffee, I'll do so mindfully. So just picking some bits of the walking that you can commit to doing so mindfully. One that I did that was effective for my practice was I set the intention to every time I walked up or down the stairs, I would do it mindfully at home. So I worked at home a lot. My office was up and the fridge and stuff was down. So lots of time up and down. And if I got halfway up the stairs and I realized I'm not doing this mindfully, I would go back down the stairs and start over. And that kind of trained the mind to go, he's going to just back you up. You might as well just just do it right from the outset. Get this over with. I'm being facetious there. But maybe there is a little bit of an element in that in terms of wanting to be efficient about it. So just setting those times of walking. There's lots of opportunities to practice walking meditation. And it doesn't have to be slow. So when we're doing formal meditation, we tend to go very slowly, because it just allows us to really feel into what's arising. But you can practice at any speed. So, you know, you start slowly, maybe speed it up a bit when you're doing your formal practice, and then just go for walks in your neighborhood at regular speed, and you'll get the idea of what normal speed walking mindfulness feels like, and then it'll integrate in, much easier into your daily practice. When I was with the monks, Thich Nhat Hanh monks, one of them noticed that I would go jogging. So he said, "Oh, would you like to go for a mindful jog with me?" Because he was also a jogger. I said, "Sure. I'm not sure what this is, but give it a try." But his idea of mindful jogging was running through the woods mindfully, and I don't know how he did this, because I was just trying not to fall over logs and put my foot into holes and twisting. But he would just, he was like a gazelle or something, and just through the woods. And but he would do mindfully, and he was, I feel the faster I go, the higher in my body mindfulness, the awareness is placed. So when I walk slowly, it's the bottom of my feet. When I'm going through the forest, it's my arms. And his arms would literally go like this as he ran. You can just see him like, he's bringing mindfulness to his arms. And his legs just seem to do whatever. It was a practice for him. So yeah, you can bring it to any activity like that. If you go to the gym, rather than having earbuds on and listening to music, which, you know, you see a lot in the gym, right? The TVs are all on. And, you know, in those pauses that you take, if you're lifting weights in particular, there's always a pause in between sets that you're supposed to, you know, wait 2 minutes or whatever. You literally set a timer in a lot of cases. Just bring mindfulness. Use those 2 minutes to practice mindfulness. So mindful walking, mindful exercise, as John Kabat-Zinn calls it, coming to our senses throughout the day. So those sense doors is, you know, what we're being aware of, because that's your experience. So we're just continually coming to our senses to is what awareness of your experience is. Being aware of what's coming through all the senses, including thought. So being alert and not lost in mind chatter. And, okay. Urge surfing. Oh, I've got that too. Okay. Urge surfing. So many of us, we have impulses, urges that are cravings that arise, perhaps even addictions. Learning how to, when we notice those arising, be able to tune into the actual bodily experience of that craving or addiction arising, and noticing it as it arises. And you'll notice that cravings have an ebb and flow to them, and you can ride a craving much like you ride a wave. You might not stop the waves, but you can learn how to surf, as the saying goes. You learn how to surf the waves. So that's another practice with urges that are arising, cravings. Well, I've got a story here. So you're coming off a shorter retreat, more than a weekend, less than a 5 or 7 day retreat. But there's a certain stillness that arises. So here's a story about Dave. This is after he completed a 10-day Vipassana retreat, and he turns up for work zoo that he works at. And seeing how chilled out Dave is, the head, his boss at the zoo, puts him in charge of the tortoise enclosure. the turtles. And so Dave slowly walks over to the cages. And at lunchtime, the head zookeeper checks on Dave, only to see that the cage door is wide open and all the tortoises are gone. He runs up to Dave and asks, "What happened to the tortoises?" "Well," said Dave very slowly, "I opened the tortoise cage and it was like, whoosh, they were gone." So, so if you've slowed down to that degree, you might have to speed things up to drive your car. But enjoy that sense of settledness. And remember the feeling of if that's what's arisen. Maybe it didn't. Right? For some of us, a retreat is what arises is lots of stuff that we haven't had, that's been suppressed, so it's not settled at all. But for some, there is a sense of settledness, that stillness that arises. So touching that stillness is and remembering it is important for our practice. A couple minutes before we do the closing circle, are there any questions that arise for people? People asked about resources. Oh, yeah. and what is Sangha? So Sangha it means community. And so the three jewels in Buddhism are Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So Buddha is your Buddha nature. Dharma is the teachings. And Sangha is the community. So practicing community in community is an important part of Buddhism, at least. It actually is of all spiritual traditions. So there are communities out there. I mean, I have a Sangha that meets on Wednesday nights in Ottawa. There's a card out there if you want the information on that Sangha. It's a lovely group. Been going for 6 years now. It's recently growing. We've recently gone from a fairly small group to a much larger group. so that's important. And there's something about practicing in a community. It just supports. We don't feel like we're like lone rangers or something in this. We feel there's support in what we're doing. We can ask questions and we always have some dialogue about our practice. Just meditating in a group feels different than meditating, doing formal practice by yourself as well. So so Sangha can be an important part of supporting your practice as you move forward. I told the golf course story. Can you recommend books? There's so many books out there. This is set on Vipassana. You know, depending on what you like to read, Joseph Goldstein has a new book called Mindfulness. It's a big, thick, which if you like, if you want to learn about all the lists, the nuts and bolts of the practice in a well-written, accessible way, I would recommend that book. A book that I just recently reread for, I don't know how many times I've read it, but I just recently reread it. It's been around for a while, is the Tara Brach's book, Radical Acceptance. That's a lovely book. I read the first chapter, I'm going to read that again. And I read it again, and I put it down and came back to it. I think I'm just going to read the first chapter again. And I subsequently went deeper into it, but the first chapter is just like a jewel. It's just so powerful in how she presents her journey and what acceptance means to our practice. So that's a book I would recommend. There's so many. Jack Kornfield has Being Dharma, It's a beautiful book about integrating practice into our life. There's so many. Ajahn Sumedho has a wonderful book that's online for free on the Four Noble Truths. He talks about each of the three insights for each of the Noble Truths, and that's a lovely book as well. If you're interested in reading about, several people asked about enlightenment and nirvana. Adyashanti, Adya Shanti, his books are pretty much about enlightenment. He's one of the few teachers that just says, "Yeah, this is enlightenment. This is what happened. This is the here are the practices." Yeah. So he's very open about his enlightenment. So that's another resource of books. And of course, Dharma Seed. If you Google dharmaseed.org, I think it is. If you just Google Dharma Seed, there's just many, many talks there that you can listen to as well. It's a wonderful resource. Somebody asked about the talks from this retreat. So on the Sangha has a website in Ottawa, payattention.ca. So if you go to payattention.ca, these two talks will be there. I think they're also put on Dharma Seed, but I can never find my talks on Dharma Seed. It's like it's...
On the TNI website?
They're on the TNI website? Okay.
I don't know. There are some talks on the TNI.
Yeah, I can never find them. I go to Dharma Seed and I put my name in there and nothing came up.
No,
but
I don't think TNI digits are necessarily on Dharma Seed.
So yeah.
Necessarily, but some teachers might be. But... there are some talks on TNI website.
TNI website as well.
Ajahn Viradala's site, the monastery site, his talks.
His talks are online as well, yeah. Ajahn Viradala is the monastery near Perth. Some wonderful resources, a beautiful man. There's lots around. On the payattention.ca, I also have a whole series of talks from a longer retreat on the Four Noble Truths. I just gave a retreat in Winnipeg on a 5-day retreat, so there's 5 talks on the Four Noble Truths, which there's more depth, obviously, when each, spread over those days. So there's some books. Any questions? Yeah.
Is it possible to get a copy of the poem Black Grief?
Oh, Kindness?
Yes, Kindness.
Naomi Shihab Nye. Kindness poem. It's a very popular poem.
Okay.
Yeah. If you can't find it, let me know.
Okay.
Anything else coming up for folks? Okay, well, let's move into our...
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.